Today I'm joined by Nico, the geopolitical analyst from geopoliticalmonitor.com, for our monthly checkup. Nico, glad to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me back, James.
Nico, what would you like to talk about this month?
Well, there are four issues that have been going on in the past month or so that are of particular interest. The first is the ongoing situation with the American, and by extension, the global economy, what with financial deregulation, the subprime mortgage issue, and general financial instability. The second topic is the rising price of rice, wheat, and other foods, which is tied very intimately to the economic problems that we've been seeing. And we'll discuss that a little bit more in depth later. And then the Zimbabwe elections, which are quite interesting, all the political maneuverings that have been going on with respect to them. And finally, China and the protests in Tibet.
All right, a lot on the plate. Let's start right in there with the subprime mortgage fallout. What can you tell us about ongoing financial instability in the U.S.?
So to give some context to the American economic and military position, of course, the United States rose to power post-World War II when it had a very strong production capacity and also was a producer and exporter of oil. This was when Europe and other wealthy nations were in ruins. And in a very fundamental way, we can understand the economic woes that we see today by the depreciation, the loss of those economic fundamentals in the American economy. The United States has largely exported its production capacity to third world countries where labor is very inexpensive. And it has also stopped exporting oil. It's now a net oil importer and has been producing less and less since the 1970s when the supply of oil being produced in the United States has started to decline. So the economic fundamentals of the United States are not what they once were and are not what they were at the time when the United States rose to its position of global dominance that we see today. So what that means when the United States economy loses fundamentals is that it doesn't have that export capacity, it doesn't have the oil, but it still has the military and the global financial system that's to its benefit that were created as a result of its rise to dominance. But when the United States doesn't have those economic fundamentals, it means that challenges to the military and financial system are much more threatening and are potentially much more harmful to the United States because the United States now relies on foreign money to fund its military to enforce the global economic system, which brings all of its wealth back to the United States. So this means that it has to fund its military, fund its enforcement through either inflation by printing more and more American dollars, as the Federal Reserve has been doing very rapidly over the past number of years, but in recent months especially, and two, sell bonds to foreign countries and foreign investors. And this is what's been funding American military adventurism for some time. But when we have this instability coupled with significant financial deregulation, which we've seen since the end of the Great Depression, when the New Deal financial regulations were put in place to prevent a second Great Depression, we have increased instability in the financial markets. Now, in 1999, the Glass-Steagall Act, which was the most fundamental securities and financial act that restricted and provided oversights in the financial markets, was repealed. And what this has allowed banks to do is be involved in both banking elements and investment elements as well. Consequently, you have a situation where the banks can underwrite the subprime mortgages, which is essentially giving loans to people who can't afford to pay them back, bundling them, lying to people or misrepresenting the amount of risk involved in the loans, and then selling them back to the public and back to other banks at a significant profit. And this was possible because of the financial deregulation that's been going on for quite some time now. And what we've seen as a result of the subprime situation, because inevitably it becomes apparent that both the securities and the mortgages themselves are bad bets, are bad loans, are bad products, what we see is financial collapse and financial instability. And we've seen that in the United States with the collapse of the international investment bank, Bear Stearns, and then the sell-off of that bank, and also in the UK with the collapse of Northern Rock. And in both situations, the government has gotten involved to help bail out those who have been negatively affected by the situation. So what we have essentially is moral hazard, where these financial institutions can take massive risks, knowing that if they fail, the American people and anyone who holds American dollars, so foreign countries who hold foreign reserves as well, will essentially bail out this financial elite. So this deregulation, coupled with the loss of economic fundamentals, has meant that the United States empire is on pretty shaky ground. And it's meant that Russia, China, South America, and other countries and regions have been increasingly able to assert themselves to the detriment of not only the American economy and the global financial system, but also to American hegemony.
And how do you see this playing out in the near, in the short term? Do you think there's any way for the U.S. empire to regain its footing, or is this just an inevitable slow decline, or will it be a rapid decline?
Well, it's one of those things where you know the long-term result. The current system is unsustainable. The United States won't be able to maintain its position. But the short term, it's hard to say, because we've seen numerous downturns and collapses in the past. And people have often said, oh, this will be the one, this will be the big collapse. But whether or not this is it, it's hard to say. What's clear is that the United States economy is on a downward trend, and that will reflect the American military and geopolitical situation as well. Whether or not this is the nail in the coffin of the American empire, perhaps not, but we're certainly on that long and slow decline. So I think we will see that decline, not necessarily in the very short term. But it will have significant effects on the markets, and that ties into what we've been seeing lately with the futures prices of important foodstuffs.
Absolutely. Can you get a bit into the food prices and where that's going?
In the past, over past quite some time, but especially in the past couple of months, we've seen significant increases in the future prices of commodities such as wheat and rice and other food products. Now, what a future is the price that people are willing to pay for a commodity at a date in the future. The spot price is what people are willing to pay to get that commodity today. So what has happened with the economic uncertainty in the United States and globally is that investors have been wanting to move their money away from equity, away from companies, which they see as being likely to collapse or decline, and towards safer bets. And commodities such as rice and wheat are seen to have strong fundamentals for a number of different reasons. One, the increase of the use of biofuels will mean increased demand for wheat and other products that can be made into biofuels. We've seen an increase in meat consumption in India and China and developing countries. And meat, of course, requires enormous amounts of grain to produce. And we've also seen droughts and a spread of a deadly wheat fungus that's moved from Africa to South and East Asia. And then underlying all of this, of course, is the increase in oil costs. And all foodstuffs in the modern agricultural system are very reliant on oil for tractors, for fertilizers, for all sorts of different components. So the input prices are expected to increase as well. So for these reasons, investors have flooded the futures market, drastically increasing the prices. And the result has been that the price of these goods has gone up significantly. And in response, countries have put export bans or quotas on these grains. So we've seen countries like Brazil, China, India, Egypt, Vietnam, and Cambodia, all major rice producers, have either banned outright or put an export quota on rice to make sure that they can meet their domestic demand. And what this has meant is that importing countries like Bangladesh, Indonesia, and Iran have been unable to import the grains that they have previously. So this means significant price increases for poor people who are unable to by the amount of rice or any rice as they were previously. And this has resulted in food riots in numerous countries, Haiti most notably, but also countries like Egypt, Mexico, Morocco, and a number of other countries. So what we've seen is financial speculation put a spike into the price of foodstuffs, resulting in geopolitical consequences, riots, and of course, human suffering and potentially starvation.
It's important, I think, that you mentioned the financial speculation aspect to the rising costs. Many analysts have noted that the price of oil is propped up to an extreme, as much as a third of the price of a barrel of oil is comes from the future speculation on the market. What can you say about investors propping up the price of these food prices artificially?
Well, there's the economic argument that by allowing the free trade of a good, you'll end up pricing it appropriately, and that will ensure that demand and supply reach an equilibrium. Now, the problem with that is when you have significant disparities in wealth, you can have people using their wheat or their grains to feed animals, to eat the animal flesh. You can have them using biofuels while other people starve. So certainly the disparity in wealth throughout the world has significant consequences in this respect. And also when you have markets that aren't free markets, you have OPEC, you have hoarding, you have various powerful players, that adds another dynamic. So it's a complex question, but the reality of the situation is that these major players exert significant influence over the price of oil and other commodities that aren't necessarily freely traded. And it is a reflection of the broader Western-created financial system, which is a tool of neocolonialism to extract wealth from colonial or poorer countries to the benefit of Western, more powerful nations.
That's absolutely true, and I think an important aspect of that is the consolidation of the industry, the agricultural industry, in the hands of fewer and fewer players. Some big names get a lot of attention, like Monsanto, but I think generally the agricultural business is becoming consolidated in fewer and fewer hands. The more conspiratorial minded might say that there's maybe other reasons behind the rising food prices.
Absolutely, and that's quite by design. You have a Henry Kissinger quote from 1970 where he said, "Control oil and you control nations, control food and you control people." So I think that's what we're seeing with the major biotechnology companies, such as Monsanto, as you say, trying to exert power over food. You have things like the Terminator seed that can't be replanted in order to control people and, by extension, have political control as well. And there's also the speculation that starvation is and can be used as a tool to eliminate unwanted people. So there's all sorts of undertones along those lines as well.
Where do you see this story going in the short term? What are the geopolitical ramifications of this over the next few months, for example?
Well, I think the spike in prices that we've seen just now are largely due to speculation. So they don't necessarily reflect the underlying system, the underlying position relating to supply and demand. But I think there's no question that in the long term, food prices will continue to rise, if only due to increased demand from developing countries, rising population, and the increase of oil, which also relates to increased demand, and some would say to peak oil, decreasing supply. So in the long term, we're going to see increased food costs and inflation.
And where do you think this will have the most impact in a geopolitical sense?
Well, it's going to have the most impact on people who have difficulty affording the necessities of life, people who rely on inexpensive wheat or inexpensive rice to stay alive. And we've seen that already with the increased prices. It's poorer countries with people who rely on those lower prices to survive, such as Haiti and several African countries where we've seen riots, that the effect has been most apparently felt. But I think Western countries will start to feel it more and more as the food prices go up. There are a lot of poor people in rich countries as well.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Well, let's turn our attention to Africa for a moment. What can you tell us about the recent elections in Zimbabwe?
Well, Zimbabwe itself is no stranger to food riots, not recently, but over the last number of years, as the white farmers have been removed from their farmland and replaced largely with cronies and supporters of Robert Mugabe, the leader of the ZANU-PF party, who took over from the white minority rule of Ian Smith in 1980. Now, what we've seen just recently with the March 29th, 2008 election, of course, the background being the destruction and decline of the country of Zimbabwe due to what many would say as mismanagement by Mugabe, has been increased dissatisfaction amongst the Zimbabwean people. We've seen hyperinflation. One estimate has been 4,000% inflation. So the money has become worthless. There are food shortages. There are all sorts of civil liberties violations. So there are a lot of people who are very discontent about what's going on in the country. And we've also seen mass emigration from the country into neighboring regions. So with the March 29th election, we had effectively what people overwhelmingly say is a situation where Mugabe and the ZANU-PF party lost the election. They didn't have the capacity or the power to rig it, and the vote tallies were going to show that the ZANU-PF party had lost. So rather than concede defeat and pass the reins over to the Movement for Democratic Change party leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, we've had Mugabe simply not release the results and crack down on the MDC party supporters who have been brutalized, beaten, and in some cases killed. And the leader of the MDC, Tsvangirai, has fled the country, and there's been a political stalemate as Mugabe refuses to release the results, and international pressure has mounted to either come to a resolution, a power-sharing agreement, as was the case in Kenya just recently, or to simply release the results and potentially concede defeat. But the interesting wrinkle in all of this was that 3 days after the election, Zimbabwe made a request to China, which has taken an apolitical stance with respect to Africa. They don't get involved in the internal policies of African nations, is their slogan in trying to gain access to resources. So 3 days after the election, Zimbabwe requested 77 tons of arms from China, and China sent them off by ship to South Africa, where they would be unloaded and transported by land to Zimbabwe, presumably to be used by Mugabe and his supporters to brutalize the Movement for Democratic Change supporters and maintain control. But interestingly, what happened was that when the boat docked in South Africa, the South African Transport and Allied Workers Union refused to unload the arms. And without their help, the arms sat there with nowhere to go. So eventually the ship left port and traveled around the South African region by sea looking for a country to dock. But the various South African region nations all united in saying that they would not assist in unloading the weapons. So eventually China conceded and said that it would send the ship home. And just very recently, just prior to this interview, I noticed that a report has been released that a partial recount has been made and announced, showing that Mugabe's ZANU-PF party has lost the election. So whether this will mean that Mugabe will step down, or whether it could be the start of a potentially brutal attempt to maintain power, is yet to be seen, but it's certainly something that will continue to have significant repercussions on the region and the neighboring countries, both through mass emigration and also through the general stability of the region.
But speaking about China, what can you tell us about Chinese involvement not only in Africa, but also the Chinese geopolitical situation given the upcoming Olympics?
Well, As you say, the Olympics are going to be held in China, and this has put China under the international spotlight. And this recent situation in Zimbabwe certainly hasn't helped from a public relations perspective, nor has China's involvement in Sudan, shipping arms to Sudan to be used in the Darfur region, Now, that's an area that has significant oil deposits that China is interested in gaining control of. But also, the Olympics have been used to highlight the issue of Tibetan independence. Now, what happened was significant protests took place in the Tibet region in order to promote the cause of and raise awareness of Tibetan independence and what many term to be cultural genocide, the destruction of the Tibetan culture and the imposition of Chinese practices and ways of living. Now, what happened is the protests turned violent when a number of protesters started attacking and being violent towards the police and the authorities. Now, Britain's GCHQ, which is the intelligence unit in Britain that surveys the world using satellite images, has said that it has proof that the People's Liberation Army of China have used soldiers to act as provocateurs to incite violence in order to justify cracking down on the Tibetan protesters. Now, anyone here in Canada who attended or is aware of the SPP protests that took place in Montebello, Quebec this past summer knows that using agent provocateurs to incite violence at protests is not the sole domain of China, but is prevalent here in Canada and in Western countries as well. So this is something that is an old trick that the British GCHQ is alleging that China has been involved with. Now, China's response to this allegation is that the United States and Western countries are using the Tibetan issue in an attempt to destabilize China and to fragment China. And they indirectly point out both Western portrayals of the situation in the media and also the CIA backing of the Tibetan movement and the Dalai Lama ever since the 1950s. Now, from China's perspective, Tibet is very important because that whole region is essentially a wall to India. The mountains create a significant barrier. So as long as China holds Tibet, it means that its populated eastern region is to a large extent safe from the populous South Asian region. So it's geographically very strategic and important. And then from the United States' perspective, or the Western perspective, China, of course, is the rising power and potential rival. So to discredit China in the international realm, and also to promote separation and independence and destabilize the country, is to the benefit of China's rivals and enemies. So China and others have written on the topic arguing that this is, in fact, something that has been promoted and promulgated by CIA and American assets in order to make China look bad and to destabilize the region. Now, these two positions aren't mutually exclusive, and based on the reports and the evidence that's out there, it looks as if they're both true. The United States is using the CIA to destabilize China and discredit China, and likewise, China has been cracking down brutally on all those that sees to be in opposition. So what we expect to see with the situation in China is continued protests by Tibetan people and Tibetan supporters, both in China and abroad, and the continued use of the Olympics to push this issue, having the effect of highlighting the civil liberties abuses on the Tibetan people, what many would call a cultural genocide, and attempting to push the issue of Tibetan independence or freedom and to discredit China and some of the activities that it's involved in.
All right, Nico, thank you again for your analysis, as always. Let's talk a little bit about your website, geopoliticalmonitor.com. I've noticed recently that there's been a lot of new information added. Can you tell us about some of the new information that you've added to the website recently?
Well, the site's continuing to grow. We've just welcomed two new writers to the site. Marcia, who is now our African analyst, and who is also contributing weekly forecasts, which provide a summary of weekly events and in-depth analysis of an important event from that week and what's likely to happen in the future. And we also have Ian, who is our Middle Eastern analyst, who speaks Arabic and monitors the pertinent Arabic language newspapers. So we welcome both of them on board. And they've been contributing articles on the issues that we've been talking about tonight, but also on numerous other items. So I encourage people to go to the website at www.geopoliticalmonitor.com and to check those articles out for themselves. Now, as regular listeners to the Corbett Report will know, those who wish to subscribe to Geopolitical Monitor may do so and also support the Corbett Report radio podcast at the same time by entering the coupon code JCORBETT. That's J-C-O-R-B-E-T-T into the coupon code field. And the revenues from those subscriptions will go to help support James and his excellent work.
And can you tell our listeners once again, what do they get from a subscription to your website?
Well, a subscription to Geopolitical Monitor goes towards allowing increased access to the content. So right now, those who are subscribers are able to both access the audio podcasts of a number of the exclusive articles to listen on their MP3 player or while doing other tasks, and will also be able to access exclusive content that will be restricted from the general public. So by becoming a subscriber now, you not only lock in at the current low price as the site develops, but you also have increased access and are able to receive the weekly forecast in your email inbox.
All right, sounds good. And I see you have some new backgrounders up on the site as well. Can you tell us what subjects are you covering recently?
Well, an interesting one that Andrew Marshall just wrote is on the CIA and the Afghan heroin trade. As the listeners may know, the Taliban, prior to the invasion of Afghanistan by the United States, had all but eradicated the production of opium, the plant used to create heroin, which is a significant money-making export on the illegal drug trade market. And since the invasion, when the Western forces led by the United States have regained control, opium production has skyrocketed, and Afghanistan now produces an estimated 96% of the world's heroin, a large amount of that going to Russia and Europe. So there's all sorts of interesting indications that, as with the cocaine production in Colombia, the CIA and American intelligence interests have gotten their fingers in the pie and have been involved in the production and export of the heroin. And I encourage listeners to go to the website, geopoliticalmonitor.com, and read that article if you're interested in learning more.
Absolutely. It's an important subject, and I agree that I encourage all my listeners to check that out on the geopoliticalmonitor.com website. Nico, thank you again for joining us this month, and I look forward to talking to you again in May.
Thanks for having me. I look forward to it as well.